What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
If You Go Down to the Woods, Sky by Jim Cameron, 47 Steeple Ashton, Wiltshire. Favourite TV programme, Doctor Who. 1975. A boy is lying on his back in a sea of autumn leaves. He is an unearthly child. His pale face glows and his eyes are a vibrant solid blue. The fallen leaves attack him, somehow aware he doesn't belong there. Later, tree roots manacle him to the roof of a cave, imprisoning the impostor. 1975. A 7-year-old boy watches television in Kent, probably eating banana sandwiches, almost certainly sporting a haircut and a pair of trousers dually fashioned by his mum. The boy is disconcerted by his TV counterpart's eyes, but scared that the leaves and trees will hurt him. The boy on the TV, is he really called Sky? These are only snatches of memory, but uneasy ones that have lasted 40 years, and even now they return unbidden during chilly walks in the woods. Some say that television stunts your mental growth. I was probably even more square-eyed than my telly-fixated contemporaries, but television nurtured my imagination and urged it to take flight. For TV in my childhood was weird and frightening, inexplicable and unpredictable. Something strange was always just around the corner. Any walk in our nearby woods would be an adventure. Avoiding the local rough kids, skirting round the poisonous toadstools and cuckoo pints, discovering discarded magazines and their graphic, photographic content. But there was something else, something less prosaic, more nebulous. There was always a chance, just a chance, that behind the next tree there may be the knobbly, fetal form of a Zygon. That Space Commander Travis and his beautiful mutoid minion had set a trap for us, that one day, as in the changes, everyone might gather there after shunning all the machines. Or perhaps we might come across that unearthly boy in a sea of leaves, scared and struggling. As the 12th Doctor once said, the forest is mankind's nightmare, but this safe danger was everywhere else too. Department store dummies might twitch and move and kill at any minute. Our local gasometers, the very ones used in Inferno, might once again crawl with wolfmen. We might wake up with Daleks in our hallway. That Alsatian dog at the recreation ground might be the one in Survivors that bit the old man and made him go mad, raving and frothing at the mouth. The chalky downs of North Kent are pockmarked by German bombs that fell short of their dockyard targets. These scooped out and scrubby amphitheatres were ripe for a visit from a Liberator landing party, or could provide a matrix battleground for the Doctor. A hike over heathered moors could mean an encounter with the darkest of my bête noirs, the nasty, brutish and short Sontaran, Styre. Any shore might spawn a sea devil, any marsh a drashig, any quarry an ogron-eating beanbag monster. Even everyday objects had hidden natures, hidden from grown-ups, that is. My belt allowed me to jaunt like a tomorrow person. My dad's tyre pressure gauge was a sonic screwdriver. My bicycle's reflector was a robot corpse marker. But so were the BBC's, to be fair. And in our garden, there was a certain time-space vehicle, shaped like a shed, since my big brother fixed its chameleon circuit. Nothing was as it seemed. I still sometimes find myself daydreaming along such lines, although now more as a location scout for an imaginary production in which I will no longer play a role. I still get a thrill when seeing a wind farm, with its tripods-like juxtaposition of the rural and the technological. and I'm touched whenever my 4-year-old daughter, her head full of kings, queens, damsels and dragons, asks whether a church tower we're passing might contain a sleeping princess. Long may she continue to wonder. Because many seem to think that people's lives are diminished by a love of science fiction and fantasy, that somehow those nerds are missing out on real life. But we have real lives. We have families, jobs, cars and mortgages like everyone else. But we have more than that. A different way of looking at the world, past the quiet and quotidian and into something other. I own the HTV children's serial Sky on DVD now. It may be that I only saw episode 1 in 1975, or perhaps only a trailer as the commercial channel was virtually verboten in our house, but I've seen it all now. And I finally have closure on those elusive but persistent images of the boy in the leaves. Sky is an alien child who finds himself on Earth in the wrong time. Our contemporary kids try to help him get where he needs to go, to our future, after a catastrophe known as the Chaos, to help the survivors to evolve. But nature rejects him, like antibodies fighting a disease, hence the arboreal aggression of my early memories. The Earth's immune system even forges a man to destroy him, the sinister good child, and Sky must use all his psychic, telepathic, and telekinetic powers to survive. So, the initial thrill of recognition and confirmation has gone, as has the full nostalgic rush of rewatching those half-remembered sequences for the first time. I can now file them with accuracy among the other disquieting moments provided by the serial's contemporaries. The monochrome opening hand of the Tomorrow People's titles, the queasy opening shots and haunting music of Children of the Stones, and Talvrin Thomas's ghostly, ghastly white face in King of the Castle. But the Sky DVD will remain a portal to a different, stranger time, a time when I didn't know what was impossible. It takes its place along those other portals on my shelf, bearing names such as Doctor Who, Blake Seven, and Survivors. It's there when I want it. I probably won't pick it out very often. But every time I see an October leaf, I will recall those early, eerie images of the boy with the two blue eyes. From You and Who Else.
G'day, I'm Rob.
And I'm JR, and we've just heard from Jim Cameron, who obviously a lot of people will probably recognise, is one half of the Crinoid podcast. And his essay obviously was from the book You and Who Else, about a television programme called Sky. And when I was editing You and Who Else, one of the sort of themes that would crop up throughout that book over and over again was of sort of half-remembered programmes from your childhood that you'd caught. And sometimes you wouldn't even be aware of what they were called or what the programme was about, but something about it, some image or something that happened, something would lodge into your memory and it would haunt you throughout the years. Mm. And sometimes it wasn't until a long, long time later that you'd be able to sort of, having remembered that thing again, track it down and find out what it was. And I thought Jim's essay was an excellent essay that kind of summed up that feeling of something from your childhood that wouldn't let go even till you become an adult. I'm sure that's something that you've probably experienced yourself as well, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to say, Jim Cameron, also one half of the Letter Lords here on the Doctor Who Show.
Plug. Well, of course, yeah.
But yes, I was listening to this and it got me thinking about Sky in particular, because I remember Sky very vaguely, and it can't have been when it was on transmission here in Australia, because that would have been the mid-70s when I was being born.
Yeah.
So it's probably the early 80s. So I might have been like 6 and probably just a little too young for it, which is why I don't have strong memories of it. But it is one of those shows in the back of my mind where I know I've seen it, but I might not have fully grasped it. And the essay I did for You and Who Else on Into the Labyrinth is a similar type of thing, a show I had seen and remembered some of, and my test for myself was to go back and watch it and see how much I remembered, how much I had forgotten. And that was quite an interesting experiment for me in that You and Who book, actually. So I might read that essay one day.
Yeah, I had a very similar thing in a way in my own You and Who Else essay, which I'll probably do as a reading for this, so it'll probably be on in a few weeks so people will find out. But the other essay we've got coming up is something that we've not done before, something a bit different, so we'd better explain what that is. One of the people who wrote for Contact Has Been Made was Jeff Hughes, And as you and who talking was being set up, I happened to be talking about something else with him on email. And I mentioned to him afterwards, we've got this thing coming up called You and Who Talking, where we'd like people to do these readings. Would you like to do one for us? Because I always thought of Jeff's essays as great essays in the book, and I really wanted to get one of his essays off him. And he said, no, he said, my reading voice is not something I'm happy with, so it's not something I'd really want to do. And I thought that was a particular shame, because, as I say, I thought his essays were great. And a couple of weeks later, I was talking to him again, and it just happened to strike me, these essays in this book, on this podcast, don't necessarily need to be read by the person who wrote them. I mean, obviously, it's better if they are, because that person is the person who has the best sense of what the essay's about and which are the important bits and so on. But if you're a reader of the essays, if you've read the books, you kind of bring some of that to it yourself, don't you? You put yourself in the position of the person who's writing.
Yeah, you interpret it, yeah.
Exactly. So I thought it might be nice as an experiment to try an interpretation of one of Jeff's essays where actually I'm reading it on his behalf. So the next essay you'll hear will be my voice, but it will actually be Jeff's essay. And I don't know, if we think it's a success, perhaps we might do some more of those in future with either me or with you reading them. Or maybe with somebody that the person who's written the essay nominates to read them for them. And we'll see how that goes. But here's an experiment, something we've not done on You and Who Talking. And so this will be a bit of a first for us.
Alrighty, another option for you out there if you want to get involved.
Yeah, if you'd like to hear your essay read, but you're not happy with reading it yourself, just send us an email or a message on Facebook or wherever, and we'll talk about who else could do it, either Rob or me or maybe even somebody else.
All right, well, let's listen to JR as Jeff Hughes.
I'm not much of an actor, but I'm going to give it a go.
Bonus additional content, The Early Years. Target by Jeff Hughes, 43, Connors Quay, Wales, UK. First story, Planet of the Spiders, almost certainly. One of my favourite ever scenes from Doctor Who is that wonderful one from The Green Death, in which an oversized maggot, assumed by the Doctor and his associates to be dormant and harmless, revives and goes off on a hunt for food, first stalking and then devouring the poor, helpless mouse, before noticing and fixating ravenously on the sight of Joe's bare leg. It was, I think, the unusual decision from writer Malcolm Hulk to allow us access to the internal monologue of the oversized larva that makes this scene so memorable. No? Okay then, how about the opening scene to The Time Warrior, remember? When Sontaran Commander Jingo Lynx finds himself separated from his squadron, and attempts, single-handedly, to fight off a swarm of Rutan ships before ultimately being shot down and falling to medieval Earth. Still nothing? Well then, let's go right back to the beginning, the very first Dalek story. Surely we all know the story of how Ian Chesterton first encountered the Doctor, his granddaughter Susan English, and her private tutor Barbara Wright on Barnes Common, following their involvement in a car crash. Such a great tale, which culminates with the eventual time travellers encountering a spectacular glass Dalek. I can see that some of you are still giving me blank looks here. Let me clarify for those of you who aren't getting what I'm talking about. Of course, it's the wonderful and enriching world of Target books. It may well be difficult for some younger readers to comprehend. My own daughter once took quite some convincing that people used to have to get up out of their armchairs and walk across the living room to use the manual controls that were built into the only television set in the house back in the day. But years once passed in which your average television viewer just didn't have the option of the internet, a catch-up service, a series of Blu-rays, DVDs, even VHS tapes. Heck, we only ever got repeats on the odd occasion. Watch, back then, was just what we wore around our wrists and used to tell the time, and BBC Three was no more than a little remembered minor detail in episode 1 of The Demons. Target was, to all intents and purposes, the only way to relive Doctor Who. There is much that can be, and indeed has been, said about just what Target books meant to those of us who were around back then. The ultra-prolific Terence Dix's influence in getting the children of the 1970s to pick up a book and read may not quite have spanned the globe, or spawned any hugely budgeted blockbuster movies, but make no mistake, he's up there with J.K. Rowling, especially since a great many of the adults who nudged their children and grandchildren into the direction of the adventures of young Master Potter in the first place had probably thumbed through at least one of Dix's many, seriously look it up, Target novelizations of a televised script. I'm not here today to discuss Target's output, though, or indeed to rank it in any way. How unlike a Doctor Who fan. What I remember most fondly about Target's Doctor Who range these days, now that I've seen most of the stories as they were originally broadcast, are the extra bits. The fleshed out sections of some of the stories. Some of the scenes were added by authors when they felt additional exposition was needed. Some were improvements on what was shot, or in some cases, how the author ideally intended the scene to look initially. Silver Nemesis relocates Ace's showdown with the Cybermen from a disused aircraft hangar to a deserted building site, and is improved vastly for it. And many were purely and simply examples of great writers just writing greatly. As a child, Doctor Who books were like the parent programme, a winter-based event. My birthday falls in January, so by the time it came around, I generally found that I was fairly laden with most of the previous year's output, coming as it did so soon after Christmas. Let me tell you, it took me far fewer than 12 months to read them all. As there was no real opportunity to see stories that had gone before, any book that predated the Tom Baker era was my first contact with each story. As a result of discovering the adventures of the initial three Doctors in River Song-style reverse order, I'll admit to having found a great many of the stories as televised very disappointing when I eventually got to see them. And this was due in no small part to these tales coming across like cheaply made adaptations of the books. Where, for instance, was the eroded Monoptera statue? I knew that there was one. Like the aforementioned Glass Dalek, there was an illustration in Bill Strutton's novel showing the thing. What happened to Joe Grant's introduction scene in the dynamically titled The Doomsday Weapon? And why did they decide to cut out the revelation that SIDRAT stands for Space and Intertime Directional Robot All-Purpose Transporter? For heaven's sake, these were the really interesting bits. Time has led me to realise the truth, of course, and I can live quite comfortably with the differences between the novelisations and the original stories. Adulthood has also, on occasion, led me to revisit these lovely little books, especially during the long decade and a half or so in which Doctor Who wasn't a television programme anymore. When read with older, more critically able eyes, the Target author's little additions to the Doctor Who mythos are, in general, absolutely delightful curios from a genuinely bygone age. Seriously, some of these gems of prose are particularly strong pieces of Doctor Who, and while I'm not going to dip my toes into the washaway currents of the canonicity debate, I do feel that these additional scenes amount to being the 1970s and 80s equivalent to today's Series 2 TARDISodes, Series 6 Preludes, and the specially filmed charity scenes and all of those DVD extras. They're not always complete scenes either. Sometimes an author throws in a line of dialogue that you'll find absent from the stories in their proper form. In the Space Museum, Vicky comes up with a bizarre riff off Hey Diddle Diddle during the raid on the Morog Armory. That's very silly indeed, but I still miss it whenever I watch the actual broadcast episode. The Fifth Doctor gains some extra pithiness in the Target books too. In the televised version of Earthshock, he informs the surly and homesick Adric that there isn't a taxi service goes back and forth, which is sarcastic enough. But in Ian Marter's printed version, he's harsher still, inviting the boy to step out into the time vortex and hail himself a cab. A few years later, when Frontios was novelised, the same Doctor has little time for the Gravis and his army from the off, dismissing their horrid constructions that are built using the colonist remains as a human mechano set. And believe me, Christopher H. Bidmead's description of Captain Revere enmeshed in the Tractator's excavation machine is pretty gruesome, particularly in comparison with what little the BBC's budget, as well as common decency on a family show, would allow. Of course, by now the books were more or less being released concurrently to the series from which they were being adapted, so I was more and more aware that these differences were artistic on the part of the author in question. But a part of me, deep down, saw this slightly harder Fifth Doctor as the truer one. By the 1980s, Target had really begun to get to grips with just what a hit they had on their hands with Doctor Who. Writers who were scripting the currently broadcast episodes were beginning to insist on novelising their own scripts, largely because they had realised that they were missing out on something of a payday. And this began to lead to books that told the stories that the authors wanted to tell, unrestricted by BBC budgets and tea time broadcast slots. Books like Ben Aronovich's Remembrance of the Daleks and Ian Briggs's Dragonfire began to appear, and were surely the prototypes for the Virgin New Adventures novels. I lapped up these books in particular, although Aronovich's infamous bacon sandwich moment and Briggs's inference regarding the true nature of the relationship between Ace and Glitz were probably, in hindsight, just the wrong side of gratuitous and, in truth, depict a very different Ace to the one portrayed by Sophie Aldred. Older writers wanted in on the act too. Donald Cotton novelised his own Hartnell stories, The Mythmakers and The Gunfighters, and rewrote them from scratch, turning them into riotous and ridiculously funny farces. Cotton also adapted Dennis Spooner's comic script for the Romans, resetting the narrative to present it in epistolary form, a major departure for the books and the first time I had ever read a story in such a format. I was in no doubt at all by now that the old chestnut, that Doctor Who could tell any sort of story that it wanted to, had only ever become a cliché because it was true. There's just so much to discover anew in the Target books. Fans of The Hungry Earth may be surprised to discover that the scene at the beginning in which Rory and Amy see future versions of themselves in the distance was effectively first done almost 3 decades earlier in the novelisation of Day of the Daleks. But I thought of it instantly, even though it's over 10 years since I last read it. Speaking of the Silurians, if you've never read Malcolm Hulk's Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters, you probably think that those pesky old Earth reptiles were first given names when they met the Fifth Doctor in Warriors of the Deep, but not so. To me, the Silurian Triad were always known as Morka, Kato, and Ogdell. Ah, it's that name again, Malcolm Hulk. Do you know, I couldn't point Hulk out in a photograph without guessing. And even though I like to think that I know my stuff where Doctor Who is concerned, I don't believe that I've ever read an interview with the late and great man. It is Malcolm Hulk who has informed and influenced me more than any other Target author. And he is, to me, by a country mile, the most prolific and best at producing these lovely embellishments of what are, let's face it, already terrific pieces of fiction as television productions. Malcolm Hulk always came at Doctor Who from a slightly different angle to most other writers. The motivations of his characters were of paramount importance to his storytelling. This often led to Hulk's antagonists being unmasked as the human monster. In fact, in a couple of his stories, the main villain of the piece turns out to be a British army general. Hulk, though, never resisting the temptation to tell us how all of his characters thought, what they were feeling, as I remarked right at the very beginning of this musing, internal monologue was his thing, and I grew to adore Malcolm Hulk's books for that fact. Hulk gave us some remarkable prose depictions of alien thought processes in his books. As well as the aforementioned giant maggot, he gave us the fears of an injured Silurian creature, lost and alone on the moors, and an entire chapter in the dinosaur invasion, in which we see how one of the creatures thinks with regards to the new world it finds itself encountering. There is an astonishing prologue to The Cave Monsters in which we actually experience the moment in which the Silurian elders take the decision to place their entire colony into hibernation, thus setting the scene for the whole story. It's so much more satisfying an introduction than that scene on screen. The Dinosaur Invasion is probably my favourite Malcolm Hulk book. In fact, I think that it is probably my favourite Target novelisation of them all. It definitely isn't the best of them by any means, but I love it. And the reason that I hold it in such high regard is precisely because of the additional content, with which Hulk has managed to embellish what is on TV. And he begins, as ever, with a jaw-droppingly good prologue. Hulk gives us a totally original character in Shuey McPherson, an unemployed Glaswegian drunken down in London for the cup final, who wakes up from an alcoholic stupor to discover that the city is deserted and ruined. In the course of his investigations, we learn so much about Shuey, his marriage breakup, debts, even when his friend Donald Ewing gets a 7-line cameo, merely attempting to rouse the drunken Shuey to join the evacuation of London, Hulk takes a moment to inform us that Ewing is a ship's riveter from Clydeside. Within a very few more paragraphs, we accompany Shuey as he prowls the empty city, discovering the body of a milkman in the street. Hulk doesn't even give us any warning that our first encounter with one of the titular creatures is imminent at this point. He blithely throws in the reference to the roar of the monster that drowns out Shuey's prayer before he is knocked near senseless by a giant claw. For good measure, Hulk ends the prologue with Shuey McPherson's final thought, to give up whiskey. As a 10-year-old boy, I had never before read such characterization, and it went on throughout the book. On screen, the character of Butler is your typical nasty henchman. In the book, Butler gains a scar, not simply to further the stereotype, but to subvert it. Sarah Jane Smith, in a very out-of-character moment, taunts Butler about how ugly the scar makes him. He explains that he got it in his days as a firefighter, attempting to save a child. It's one of the many opportunities that Hulk takes to show the reader the motivations of the Doctor's adversaries in this adventure. As the televised story also tells us, in far fewer words, we're not dealing with bad people here, just good and idealistic, but ultimately misguided ones. For the first time in my young life, I was beginning to realise that there was more going on in the world than just black and white, and I was getting this concept from books about a man who lives in a time-travelling phone box. Honestly, I'm merely scratching the surface here. Target also gave us such riches as an epilogue to Pyramids of Mars, in which an older Sarah Jane Smith, long after her TARDIS travels, looks up how the newspapers reported the deaths that had taken place at the old priory so many years earlier. Then there's the news in Terror of the Autons that the Autons are made of polynestine, and that the nestine consciousness hails from the planet Polymos. I could compile you a list, but apparently other people are being given space in this book. Tsk. What I will say is that Target books enrich my childhood immeasurably. It's odd, I don't actually feel that reading these little gems made me love Doctor Who any more than I ended up doing. The TV show had captured my imagination long before I'd ever picked up any book. I maintain that it is true, however, that whilst it was certainly a combination of teachers, my parents, and even Jim Henson and his fuzzy felt friends that taught me how to put together and decipher sequences of letters in order to form words and sentences, it was the Target Books gang, Messrs. Hulk, Dix, Marta, Cotton, Whittaker, et al., who taught me how to really read. Thank you, Target Books. You were quite wonderful. And that was from Contact Has Been Made, Volume 2.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.